We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne, is at the controls. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with British author David Peace. I think that some people will know him for a series of novels that he wrote that are known as the Red Riding Quartet. These are books that all revolve around the Yorkshire Ripper murders that took place in the 1970s in Yorkshire, a place where David Peace grew up. Also, police corruption is a very important theme of the books. They were very well received and were the basis for a television series that aired in the UK just last year. He's also authored the novel GB84, which is about the UK miners' strike that took place in the mid-80s, and also a novel, The Damned United, which is about a brief period in the life of the Leeds United Football Club. He wrote the Red Riding books when he was living in Japan, and he has also written some books set in Japan. And this morning, we'll be talking about what is the second in a projected trilogy of novels set in Japan during the time of the occupation. The book has just recently been published, and the title of the book is Occupied City, and it's available here in the United States, published by Knopf. And it has as its central event a sensational mass poisoning that took place in Japan during the time of the occupation. And it's something that people still think about and talk about, because the man who was accused of this crime and eventually died in prison is widely thought to be not guilty. And there remains to this day an effort of people in Japan to clear his name. And the book is quite interesting, has very interesting structure, where what David Peace does is try to look at the story from a variety of perspectives with a number of different voices. And I would certainly say, as you listen to the interview, if the story sounds interesting to you, go out and find the book, and I think that you'll find it very interesting. He's joining us this morning by telephone from across the ocean. He's in Britain, and we're pleased that he could spend some time talking with us. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. And also, you may email your questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. Mr. Peace, hello.
Hello.
Thank you very much for talking with us. We appreciate it. I think perhaps just the place to start would be to talk a little bit about the Tagen Bank case. And just a little bit to sketch out the story of what happened there at this bank in late January of 1948.
Yeah. Well, as you say, it was January 1948. This is the third year of the U.S. occupation of Japan. It was 3:30 in the afternoon. The bank was closed for business. A man knocked on the side door of the bank. They opened the door. He was Japanese. He said he was a doctor and that he'd been sent by the occupation authorities to inoculate the bank staff, because in the area there'd been an outbreak of dysentery. Now, he was in civilian clothes, but he was wearing an armband that said that he was a member of the occupation authorities. The bank staff let him in. He gathered the 16 members of the staff, which also actually included two children who were part of the caretaker of the bank's family. He poured out medicine into their 16 teacups. He told them they had to drink the medicine straight down, and then he would give them a second vaccine 1 minute later. They drank down the first medicine. They waited 1 minute. He poured out a second vaccine. They drank down the second vaccine. And within minutes, 12 of the staff were dead, including the two children. Four of them were unconscious, and the man vanished, as did some, but not all, of the bank's takings. And that really then began a huge police manhunt, which remains to this day, I think, the largest police manhunt in Japanese history. But the story was so big that it actually made the, you know, the New York Times and the London Times the next day. And as you said in your introduction, it remains a contentious story for Japanese people, because some people believe that the man who eventually was tried and convicted of the crime was actually innocent.
And he, sadly enough for him, he, as you say, he was tried, he was convicted, he was in prison, but apparently there was so much doubt as to his guilt that no one would sign the death warrant.
As you said, the actual crime took place in the January of 48. The man was called Sadamichi Hirasawa, and he was arrested in the August of the 48. Initially, he confessed. He had a kind of history of actually confessing to things or telling lies about, and basically, what people feel is he was worried about some kind of minor embezzlements and things and mistresses coming to light, and so his alibis were not very good. But anyway, he recanted his confession. He was tried in the autumn of that year and was convicted. But as you say, no Minister of Justice would ever actually sign the death warrant, so he remained on death row. In fact, I think he holds the dubious distinction of being the man who lived on death row the longest, until 1987, when he died of natural causes. But as you also indicated, in Tokyo, though, to this day, a campaign is ongoing to posthumously clear his name.
So this was, just so people are clear here, what this was, apparently what this was a bank robbery, and the strategy that the robber employed was to go in and at least attempt to kill all of the people who were there so that then he would be able to take whatever money was there in the bank.
Yeah, that would be, if one was to say that the sole motivation for the crime was robbery, that would be the conclusion you would draw. But even when you say it, it sounds kind of vaguely preposterous. In 1948 in Tokyo, it was reasonably easy to get hold of a firearm. For example, there was a lot of decommissioned weapons about. It seems a very, very elaborate way to a kind of hazardous way to rob a bank, in terms of whether people would, you know, knowing how long it would take for people to be rendered unconscious and so forth. It does seem that if money was the sole motive, a strange way to rob a bank.
Yeah, there are so many. The story itself, the incident, the outcome, how it is that the police managed to find the man that they charged with the crime. It's just that story itself has so many fascinating and odd details, and I don't want to give too much away here, but yeah. The fact that they used what is a very Japanese practice, that is the practice of people exchanging cards, business cards that have their name, their title, who they are, because to the Japanese, when you meet somebody else, knowing who they are, it's very important to your how you relate to that other person to know who they are. So people exchange cards that says right away, this is my name, this is my title, this is what I do. And that that in this particular case, that was a key to the police finding someone that they did end up charging, although, as you say, there are a lot of questions about whether or not this individual was guilty.
As you say, it's very, it is, I think, one of those only in Japan moments, because he, you know, and when the doctor at the supposed doctor introduced himself to the bank staff, he gave the customary name card. The name card did belong to an actual doctor. When the police tracked down the actual doctor and found that he had an alibi and couldn't have possibly done the poisoning, they then had to find who he had given his name card to in the course of the last year, since he'd had this batch of name cards printed up. And one of the people he exchanged his name card with was this painter, Hirasawa, And Hirasawa, of course, was unable to produce the name card he'd been given. So it was believed that, you know, this was one of the circumstantial pieces of evidence against him.
Mm-hmm. And this is one of those examples of how much police work involves just dogged plodding along, to people, because then the police, this doctor had handed out hundreds of these cards.
Yeah, I mean, because he'd toured, he had been a member of, like, the occupation health authorities, and one of his jobs was to tour the country in advance of a tour by the Japanese emperor to check that the areas were safe enough for the emperor to visit. And in the course of this pre-tour, if you like, he handed out, as you say, hundreds of name cards, and the police had to go and try and find every single name card.
So I understand that your perhaps introduction to the story, the thing that got you interested, was, as you mentioned, to this day there are people in Japan who believe that this man Sadamichi Hirasawa was not guilty, and it was because you happened to read a newspaper story about this effort to clear his name.
Yes, when I lived in Tokyo from 1994 till last Easter 2009, and quite early on I was aware that from the English language newspapers in like the Japan Times did a piece about the ongoing campaign to posthumously clear Hirasawa's name. And one of the things that they do almost, I think it's every year, they hold an exhibition of Hirasawa's paintings, because he was not a particularly well-known painter, but he was a painter. And the newspaper was running a feature on an exhibition, and I went along to the exhibition, and that was where I became. That was my initial introduction to the case. There have been a couple of. It's been mentioned in a number of other books. There was actually a book called "Flowering the Bamboo," which was an American book, which was written about the case in the around the time about the late 80s. So there was an English language book about the case.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is novelist David Peace, and we are talking about his book Occupied City. It's just recently been published here in the United States, published by Knopf, and it is the middle book in a trilogy set in Japan during the time of the occupation. The first was Tokyo Year Zero, which was published in 2007, and then there will be this third book, tentatively, I believe, to be titled Tokyo Regained. He's also, I'm sure people will know him, for his novels that are set in Yorkshire in the 70s and revolve all around the Yorkshire Ripper murders that took place there at that time. These books are known as the Red Riding Quartet. We're talking here this morning about Occupied City. Questions, welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Is there something in particular about the notion of occupation or about Japan at this time that interests you?
Well, yes. I mean, I've been living in Tokyo for quite a while, but while I was living in Tokyo, I was actually writing mainly about Yorkshire, the place I was from. Mm. But the longer I lived in Tokyo, the more interested and fascinated I became by the city. And the thing that probably fascinated me the most was how this city had rebuilt itself after the war. I used to live in what's known as the East End of Tokyo, which was the place that in March 1945 had suffered the worst of the firebombing. And I was always very conscious that I was walking around on a place that had been reduced to ashes, and yet, you know, there were not really any monuments or like you might have in England, like war memorials and things that you might have in England. And I felt that, you know, this was this ultra-modern city I was walking around, but somehow was built on a kind of a forgotten or secret layer of history. And I then started to very tentatively research a way in which to tell the kind of story of the resurrection of Tokyo, if you like. I was drawn then to to free crimes that occurred during the occupation period. The first, which is the subject of Tokyo Year Zero, was what's known as the Kodaira case, where a Japanese former soldier murdered and raped and murdered 10 women in Tokyo between 1945 and 46. Then the Tagin incident, which we discussed, and then the third book will deal with the unsolved, still mysterious death of the president of the Japanese National Railways in 1949. I thought these stories had a kind of, if you like, a political and social dimension beyond simply being crimes that allowed me to try to examine that city and that country at that particular time. And obviously one of the things that fascinated me most was this notion of the defeat, the surrender, and then the occupation.
Mm-hmm. And all of the crimes at the heart of the three books are all I'm sure were very big stories in Japan. And as you said, the Tagin case was a story outside of Japan. These three things, they're all remain unsolved.
No, the Kodaira case was solved.
Ah.
That case, to be honest, I think really until Tokyo Year Zero, had been largely forgotten. I thought the case fascinated me because this this man who had been a soldier in the Japanese Imperial Army in China, where he admitted to murdering and raping Chinese civilians and receiving medals for it, and then he was returned to Tokyo and continued to do the same thing but to Japanese women, and he was caught and hung. One of the ways in which another aspect of the case was that he was able to lure and entrap his victims by the promise of food and work, which obviously was indicative of the state of the city in 1945 and 46. And really, rather than the actual rapes and the murders, what I found fascinating was this notion of this soldier returning and basically continuing to do what he'd done before, and also the way in which his victims were both victims of him, the killer, and also the social and economic environment of that time, of that ruined city. Mm. So as you say, the Tagin incident remains, although Hirasawa was convicted, it still remains quite a contentious issue for Japanese people in that many of them do not believe he was guilty. And then the third case, what's known as the Shimoyama case, about the mysterious death of the Japanese National Railways president, that is, some people believe it was suicide, some people believe it was murder, some people believe that the communists and the trade unions were responsible, some people believe that the American occupation was somehow complicit in it. So it's similarly to Occupy City, there's many conspiracies surrounding it.
Mm. When we were talking just a little bit earlier about the basic outline of the story in the Tagin case, the fact that this man, he walks into this bank that was closed, that they were just trying to do the paperwork and get the bank closed up for the day. He says, he identifies himself as a physician who's working with the occupation. He says, there's some illness going around here, but I have some medicine for you that you can take and make sure that you don't get sick. And it turned out it was poison, and it seemed on the face of it, although, as you say, it seemed a rather baroque way to go about it, that it was a bank robbery and that his means of achieving that was to kill everybody and then take however much money there was. Mm-hmm. The fact that it was carried out, however, in the way that it was, got a lot of people thinking and apparently got you thinking about what the Japanese had done, the experiments the Japanese military had done in China during the time that they were there occupying Manchuria in World War II, biological and chemical warfare experiments. And you raised this question, well, you know, could it indeed have been someone who was involved in that, was responsible for the Tagin incident? Did people at the time try to draw any connections between these two things?
Oh, yeah, yes. I mean, it wasn't, I take no credit for that theory. It's quite widely, I mean, it's one of the widely held, people who believe Hirasawa was innocent believe that the most likely culprit was somebody with a connection to the Japanese bacteriological warfare program in occupied China. That unit are known as Unit 731, and I think many of your listeners may be familiar with the infamous nature of what they did. I mean, I've even seen there was an episode once of the X-Files which touched on this. Why this? I mean, there are a number of reasons why Unit 731 became attached to the Tagin case. Firstly, there was this notion that the man was a doctor, and that he had a very precise way of pouring out these medicines, and a very authoritative way of dealing with the bank employees. There was a suggestion that similar incidents had occurred in banks and in government offices in mainland China, where people had gone in and carried out some things very similar to the Tagin case. Then there was the notion that at that time the occupation authorities had done deals with the people who were head of the bacteriological warfare program, basically in exchange for the information from the experiments in China, these people were granted immunity from prosecution. A theory went that a disgruntled member of Unit 731 who had fallen on hard times had not been granted any immunity and had not been given cash payments, did this Tagin robbery as a way in which to embarrass Unit 731 and the Americans and try to strike a deal for himself. This is one of the most common theories.
Yeah. I think that it's true that all of the novels that you have written use real events and perhaps also real people as the jumping off point, and for you to go and to tell a story and explore themes that clearly you're interested in, and I wonder how it is you have thought about that rather than perhaps making a story completely out of whole cloth, doing something that is completely fictional. What your attraction to perhaps some real event as the core of the work?
Well, I think maybe it's just a fundamentally lack a good imagination, but seriously, I think I do believe that. But that crime is a way in which to examine particular societies at particular times. It began really through with writing about growing up in West Yorkshire in the 1970s and 1980s, and this Yorkshire Ripper case, which really dominated the news and the lives of people here from about 1975 through to early 1981. I just wanted to know why. I suppose simply, I wanted to know why this serial killer had committed these crimes and how he'd been able to do it for so long during my childhood. And then that's extended to things as you touched on in the introduction, such as the miners' strike of 84-85, and then as I said earlier, how Tokyo rebuilt itself. I mean, I'm drawn to real life incidents because these are things I don't really understand, and so really there's so much kind of mystery in reality that I don't really feel the need to make things up. I'd rather just try to attempt to understand what had happened.
And do you think that there were a lot of similarities between life in Yorkshire at that time, the 70s and 80s, and what life was like in Japan in that immediate post-war period?
You could make some superficial, like there's some superficial similarities in terms of, the Yorkshire to some extent in the 1970s was a defeated place in terms of like economic recession, collapse of heavy industry and so forth, but the situation in Tokyo was in 45, 46 was obviously much, much worse. Yeah.
We are at our midpoint in this hour of Focus 580, and let me take the opportunity to introduce once again our guest, writer David Peace. He is known for a number of novels, GB84, which was about the UK miner strike of the mid-80s, The Damned United, which is about a chapter in the life of Leeds United Football Club. He's maybe primarily known for his novels that make up the Red Riding Quartet. These are all revolve around the Yorkshire Ripper murders of the 70s that took place in Yorkshire, where he grew up. Also was the subject of a very popular, highly acclaimed television series that aired in the UK just last year. He's also authored now two novels and what will be a trilogy of novels that we've been talking about here, set in Japan during the period of occupation, and that were written during the time when he actually was living in Japan. The first was Tokyo Year Zero, published in 2007. The new one is Occupied City, and it's published by Knopf. And the third one, Tokyo Regained, at least that's the title that I have seen, will be published sometime soon. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. As I think I mentioned, or you mentioned, or maybe both of us did, that you were actually living in Japan at the time that you wrote the books that were set in Yorkshire, and that somehow that was actually to be in a foreign place was helpful to you when you were writing about the place that you had grown up.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think for me, when I was writing the Red Riding Quartet, I was really trying to recapture that time and place as accurately as I could. I spent a lot of time in the National Library in Tokyo researching through the British newspapers. I would come back to the flat and I would only listen to, say, while I was writing 1974, the first book, I would only listen to music from that period, or read books from that period, or see films from that period, and cut off really from the West Yorkshire as it is now. I think I was able to recreate, I hope I was able to recreate that time and place within the book, and particularly I think the language. Language changes. I'm sure it's the same in Chicago. Language changes all the time. Mm-hmm. People pick up new catchphrases off the television. Kids have new slang words all the time. And I really wanted to try to get the language right. And so just by being so far away and able to kind of insulate myself from the present, I think really helped. I mean, hope helped me to recreate that time and place within the books.
I'm curious if you could talk a little bit about how and why you happened to go to Japan. It's my understanding that you went there to teach English, and that at least initially when you got to Japan, you didn't speak any Japanese.
I left university in Manchester in the north of England, and I then went to Istanbul to teach for 2 years. I lived there. The Turkish economy at that time was so bad, I couldn't really earn a living. So a friend of mine in Turkey said, just go to Japan and you work there a year and you'll be able to pay off your student loans and your bank loans, of which I had many. And so I make no bones about it. I went to Japan initially just to earn money to clear my debt. When I got to Tokyo, though, I did, with no disrespect to Istanbul, I found it a kind of easier place. Tokyo was an easier place to live, and I quickly got into a good routine of, I was working for a language school where I taught from 1 p.m. till 9 p.m, and so I've always been an early riser. So every morning I just started to write the books. I mean, basically the books came out of the fact that there was a small English language bookshop, and I read a lot of the second-hand books, and I must have read and traded all the books they had, the crime books, and I simply ran out of books and then decided I would write the crime novel I wanted to read, which was set in the 70s in West Yorkshire. That's how it really began, and I ended up in Tokyo simply initially for money, but then I stayed because I liked it, and you know, I met my wife, who was Japanese, and we had two children, and were settled there.
Yeah, the book Occupied City has an unusual form, and yeah. I know that you, when you decided you got interested in this story, and you learned more about it, and you read more about it, your feeling was that you can approach it from so many different angles that one voice wouldn't be adequate to tell the story. So you have many voices here telling the story.
Yeah, the first book in the trilogy, Tokyo Year Zero, is a pretty straightforward, it's told from the perspective of a detective hunting for this serial killer. And when I finished Tokyo Year Zero, I almost immediately began Occupied City, the second book. And again, I was using a kind of policeman to tell the story. But, you know, the more and more I researched about the story, there were, so as we've touched on before, so many different tangents, so many theories, conspiracies surrounding the case. But I thought, you know, it wasn't possible for this one detective to be able to kind of narrate all these different points of view. And for a while, I was quite, you know, unsure of how I was gonna be able to kind of, you know, tell a story that touched so many lives as well, and you know, was so huge. And then actually, I went back to one of the very first stories I'd ever read when I arrived in Japan in English, which was a story called "In a Grove" by the writer Akutagawa. And I think listeners might be familiar with the Akira Kurosawa film Rashomon.
Mm-hmm.
Which he made based on this story. And in this story, it's a story of a rape and a murder, but it's told from six different perspectives. You have the victim, you have the killer, you have one of the people who was killed, you have witnesses and so forth. And at the end, the reader basically has to make up their own mind. And I just thought this format, this structure, would be the best way to tell the story of the Teigen case, because there were so many different points of view, conflicting theories and conspiracies that really I wanted to kind of encourage the reader to think, you know, as I was doing for myself, and to come to their own conclusions.
Yeah, I think that certainly some sections of the book, I think that there's an unusual quality to the language, and I think the way I would describe it, in a sense, that there are some parts of it that almost you'd think might have been written in some other language and then translated into English. Were there some ways, do you think, that something about Japanese, the rhythm of the language, or the way that the Japanese would say something, and how that might be different from the way you might say that in English? Do you think that any of that crept into the work?
Well, to be honest, I wasn't particularly conscious of that. I was more conscious of that in Tokyo Year Zero, the first book, where I actually use I even use Japanese phrases within the book, for particularly, for example, to give one crude example, in Japanese, when a clock or a watch is ticking, they don't say tick-tock, they say chikutaku, chikutaku, chikutaku. So I use that kind of, those kind of phrases a little bit in the first book. In the second book, you know, because you also have, for example, one part's narrated by a Russian, a Soviet investigator, you have an American, you have then many Japanese. I mean, maybe that you know, subconsciously there was, you know, and having lived there so long, by the time I wrote the book, which was 15 years, maybe there is an element of that, yeah.
Well, it does. I do think that the voices, I think there were a dozen voices, people dealing different parts of the story or their reactions. And so we have police officers. We have one woman who was a survivor of the poisoning.
Yeah.
We have a man who was an American military man who's involved in the investigation of the biological chemical warfare efforts of the Japanese. And we have even the killer himself, whoever he may be. So we have these many voices, and I think you've managed to really make them very distinct and very individual.
Well, to be honest, that was my major preoccupation, was that, you know, I've always usually written with one narrator. And so it was quite, you know, I didn't want to make the voices sound too similar. And so that was a major thing, was to try to make the voices as distinctive as possible.
We are moving into about our last 15 minutes. I have a caller we'll get right to, but I do want to again introduce our guest, David Peace. The book that we're talking about is his most recently published novel. The title is Occupied City, and it's published by Knopf, about this rather sensational and many people would say to this day unsolved crime that took place in 1948 in Tokyo during the time of the occupation. And it is the second book of a trilogy, all set during the time of the occupation, and they all have a crime, a rather sensational crime, at the heart of the book, although he uses it not only to tell the story of those particular crimes, but to say a lot of other things as well. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And we do have a caller in Champaign, line one.
Yes. I find this just so interesting. And I was wondering, while you were in Tokyo, what kind of access to the police structure did you have? I mean, what kind of research did you do in regard to, say, Japanese police methodology and their investigations? And I'll just listen offline. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. Well, thank you very much. I was very fortunate that I have a Japanese publisher, and my editor, who's called Mr. Nagashima in Tokyo, he helped me greatly because after 15 years, I mean, I can speak and get by with Japanese, but my reading of the Japanese kanji is terrible. I mean, I read at the age of a five-year-old at best. He was very, Mr. Nagashima helped. We would meet once or twice a week, and we would go through the newspaper reports from the time. We would go through police reports that had been declassified. Went through a tremendous amount of documentation. But there's also quite a lot of documentation that was done by the occupation authorities as well. So there are police reports that was the Japanese submitted reports in English to GHQ as well about certain crimes, like the taking crimes. So there was a tremendous amount of research, but I could not have done it without the help of Mr. Nagashima.
Yeah. Well, again, other questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL or 9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. I wonder if you maybe feel some particular sympathy for police officers, at least in the sense that here there are people, they're really working-class people, overworked probably, underpaid, doing this very important job, not always highly respected, people who in their work, interestingly enough, really cross all kinds of socioeconomic lines, doing a very difficult job, sometimes which is probably a really boring job, and that every once in a while really stretches them and tests them and exposes them to things that probably a lot of people just would really rather not see. Is there something that interests you particularly about that occupation?
Well, I found, you know, going back to the first Tokyo book, Tokyo Year Zero, it was absolutely amazing reading the real life accounts of how the Japanese detectives had caught this serial killer, because I mean, they were, you know, this man was killing women in a city that had been destroyed, had really been razed to the ground, and hundreds of thousands of people had died. So you might think, well, people could take the attitude, well, what's one or two more people? But the police were diligent in trying to catch this man, and also they did it when they had, you know, they didn't even have proper footwear, let alone cars or telephones. Their notebooks. They had to cobble together the notebooks out of old bits of scrap paper and things. They used to have to cut up, tires, rub the rubber off tires to put on the bottom of their shoes. They could hardly feed their own families, and yet they were obsessive in the pursuit of this serial killer, which I think, to be honest, maybe it's a little pretentious or over-psychological, but I believe was basically their attempt to reconstruct their own identities in this devastated city by doing their job. And similarly, in the Tagin case, although I mean I for one believe Hirasawa was innocent, I don't actually think for a minute that the police tried to frame or set the man up. You know, again, they spent hours and hours and hours in still very harsh conditions trying to solve this case, and under an intense pressure from both the Japanese government, the media, and from the occupation authorities.
Yeah. Well, now I'm prompted now to ask the question whether you think that there are some times when being a writer is something like being a police detective in the sense that you're investigating some idea. It does, in fact, involve doing research, and it may also end up being about as much about you, that is, about the writer, as it is about the subject.
Well, I think you've got a very good point. I mean, I mentioned Mr. Nagashima, my editor. I mean, we both, I think, at the start of Occupied City, naively thought we were going to solve the case and clear it up one for once and for all. And even on this third book I'm doing now, the book about the Shimoyama incident, the murder or the death of the Japanese Railways president, again, there's always that element that you would like to find out something that's not been found out before. But I mean, I think it goes back to some kind of Sherlock Holmes childlike fantasy or something. Mm-hmm. But I think there is definitely, as you're writing, particularly when you're exploring real life crimes that took place, you do have to investigate it as thoroughly as possible.
Mm-hmm. Well, I suppose that part of the appeal of the Sherlock Holmes fantasy is the idea that eventually, with enough work and thought, all questions may be answered. And in fact, life is not like that. All questions are not answerable, and you know, maybe an awful lot of them we'd like to have answers to. We'd like to know, why did something happen? Why did somebody do something? Who was the person who did it? And at the end of the day, you just have to say, we don't know. And there's something that's really unsatisfying about that, even though that's much of life is like that.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And I mean, this is, not to put people off Occupied City, but if you are looking for a happy ending, it's probably not the book for you. So.
Well, it is gritty. If anything would define noir, I'd say this book would. And I say that knowing that there are people who like that. I would have to say I like that. Something about that sensibility, and I'm sure people would say that, you know, sounds strange, or would make me sound sort of strange, but something about that sensibility and being able to at least for a little bit to plunge into that world and also be able to leave is very pleasing.
Yeah. No, me too. I mean, I'm a huge fan of, you know, going back to people like Dashiell Hammett, Raymond Chandler, Jim Thompson, then up through James Ellroy, Walter Mosley, George Pelecanos. These are the guys I, you know, read. So very, very much I understand that, you know, the attraction of you know, particularly the harder-edged crime novels.
Yeah. I also read, in one of the things I read about you, one reviewer said that they thought that you were a political writer. Do you think that you are?
Well, you know, to be honest, I think all writers, whether they admit it or not, are political. Even if you were to deny it, that would be a political act. So I think, you know, if you're going to write about the real world, about real crimes and society, you know, I don't mean it political, like, you know, Republican, Democrat, conservative or Labour way, but I mean in an engaged sense of the word political. I think that's what you have to be. Otherwise, to be honest, the books would to me have no meaning. So I take it as a compliment.
Mm. It does seem that there certainly is an implied, well, maybe not implied, a kind of a dim view of government that comes through in a lot of your writing, or its inability to do what really needs to be done. And maybe that just goes back to the fact that what we're talking about here is a human institution, and it's staffed by people who are flawed.
Well, I think more than government, it will be more broadly what increasingly I feel the power, to be honest, is what I think that, you know, really that power corrupts, whether it's in politicians, whether it's in the media, whether it's in the police or in individuals. And I think that, you know, my books actually document the way in which, you know, in different times and different places, the same things happen, that the people without power suffer through the actions of the people with power.
I also read in a number of things I read about you that you talked about how you're working on Tokyo Regained, and that you apparently had ideas for a couple of other books, but that at least you told this one interviewer in particular, I think this was published in The Scotsman, that you had determined that you, once you got to a dozen books, that you had decided, okay, that's enough. I'm going to stop.
Yeah.
I'm not going to write anything. I'm not going to write any more novels once the 12th one's done. I'm done. Is that you really still feel that way?
Yeah. No. I mean, I just felt that you know, I do struggle with the novel as a form. I think it's quite. I mean, in many ways, I think it's quite artificial. I'm not sure how relevant. I mean, this is probably just my own limitation. So I'm not sure how relevant it is for the 21st century. I also kind of don't want to turn, you know, into a kind of where I get lazy and think, well, okay, you know, I'll do, you know, the next book will be better. I wanted to kind of, you know, make give myself a kind of pressure that, you know, I've only got 12 books to get this right. I'm not saying I would, you know, I mean, to be honest, I'm increasingly drawn to write, you know, maybe going the other way and looking at things from a non-fiction, the so-called non-fiction point of view. So, but it was more to kind of, to stop myself getting kind of lazy or complacent.
So it would not be the case that you would stop writing altogether.
I don't think I could. I've written since, as long as I can remember, you know, since I was about six or seven, I've always written kind of, written all kinds of things. So, no, I would not stop writing altogether, no.
Yeah. That's something that so many of the people that I've had the opportunity and the pleasure to talk with, writers and poets, people over and over say that same sort of thing, that somehow writing just it was something that they were compelled to do, and they remembered when they were kids that they were making up stories, and that they could trace their interest in writing all the way back. And it makes me wonder, where does that come from? And is that storytelling impulse something that's in all of us and we don't all exercise it, or some people just get more of that than others?
It's a very good question. I think it's basically the telling of stories is in the majority of people. You know, I can sit on the bus or go to the post office, and I can hear people all around me telling stories. The urge to write it down, though, that's a different thing. I'm not sure why. I mean, I don't know if it's a blessing or a curse, to be honest, but some people obviously need to write things down.
Mm. And when you started out, was this what sort of things were some of the first things that you wrote?
The very first book I ever put together was it was called GG the Magic Fox, and it was about a fox that gets wrongly accused of killing chickens. So, I mean, to be honest, things haven't changed, really.
You've been a crime writer ever since you were a kid.
Ever since, yeah.
Uh-huh. I'm one other thing, just forgive me for asking about your personal life, but now having lived in Japan for all those years and meeting someone and getting married and having a family in Japan, what was it that then moved you back to the UK?
Well, I suppose the things that moved many people. It was my parents and not getting any younger, to state the obvious. And also, I wanted my kids to kind of experience, you know, the other half of their genes, if you like. You know, they'd always lived in Tokyo, so I thought it'd be good for them to experience a little bit of Yorkshire.
Yeah. Having been away then for 15 years or more, how was the homecoming for you?
To be very honest with you, it was quite difficult because it was the best part of, you know, what with university and then Istanbul, it was the best part of 20 years. I didn't, there were many things I didn't know how to do, the tax system, for example. you know, the you know, but it's, you know, it's you know, it's good, you know, it's been good to be near my parents and so on.
Yeah. So now here for your for rounding out your dozen books, what are some of the projects that interest you now in the near future here?
Well, I mean, my main priority, you know, like what I've been working on today is to finish the third Tokyo book. And that's kind of interesting to be writing about Tokyo from Yorkshire, kind of reversing the process, if you like. I want to finish that book this year. And then one thing I'd like to do, though, is to go back to the 1970s in England and, the late 60s, 1970s, and particularly to look at the government of Harold Wilson and the rise of Margaret Thatcher during that decade not in the way I did obviously with the Yorkshire Ripper books, but in a more, you know, political sense.
Yeah. Well, there we'll have to leave it. Our guest David Peace, he's the author of The Red Riding Quartet, GB84, The Damned United, and Tokyo Year Zero. And this novel that we've been talking about here this morning, it's titled Occupied City. It's published here in the U.S. by Knopf. I'm sure you can find his other books. He's written a number of them. He's received a number of awards. He was chosen as one of Granta's best young British novelists of 2003. 2007 was named GQ, the U.K. version of GQ, Writer of the Year. He lived in Tokyo for 15 years before returning home to his native Yorkshire. And Mr. Peace, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Support for today's programs come from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine in Urbana, with wines, beers, and spirits for the series collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings are held every Saturday from 2 to 6. Information is available at 337-7704 or at thecorkscrew.com. This is WILL. WILL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois. You can find us on the web at will.illinois.edu. A lot of information on our programming there, and that's a way that you can catch up on past programs that you might have missed. That's it for us here on Focus. We want you, however, to stay tuned. There will be much more in the way of news and features, some more talk about the weather, another conversation in the 1 o'clock hour. The host for the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, Washington Post journalist David Finkel will be our guest. We'll talk with him about some of the soldiers who were part of the U.S. surge in Iraq. Finkel tells their stories in the story of the surge in the book, The Good Soldiers. At 1 minute before noon, let's take a look at the commodity contracts. In Kansas City, March wheat trading at 505 and a quarter, up 15 and a quarter. May, 516, up 14 and a quarter. In Chicago, March wheat, 496 and a quarter, up 14. May, 510 and three quarters, up 13 and a half. March corn, 362, up 3.5. May, 373 and a half, up 3.25. July, 383 and three quarters, make that 384, up 3.25. September, 390 and a half, up 3.25. March soybeans, 934, up 9.5. May, 943 and a quarter, up 8. July, 950 and three quarters, up 6.75. August, 947 and a half, up 6. September, 928, up 2.25. March meal, 274.40, up 380. March oil, 38.31, down 7. February live cattle, 88.70, down a nickel. April, 91.37 and a half, down 10. March feeder cattle, 99.90, down 7 and a half. April,